case, which is case number 80181, Jack Paul Banca versus the state of Nevada. We have Mr. Watkins representing the appellant, Mr. Giles representing the respondent. And Mr. Watkins, did you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do. Just 4 minutes.
4 minutes. Okay. Very well. You know the drill. Just keep an eye on the clock and we'll reserve that time for you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Watkins, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, as you're aware, I'm John Watkins and I'm of counsel with the Perrienti law firm representing Jack Banca. I'll address the issues in Jack's appeal in the order they appear in the briefs. The first issue, the dispositive issue here is that the DA cannot create its own offense. There is no statute authorizing or making the substitution of the misdemeanor location elements in a substantial bodily injury or death case a public offense. Here's why there is no such statute. A drunk driving his vehicle into a living room of a family resident, killing one or two members therein, has not committed a DUI offense. The living room is not a highway or premises to which the public has access.
Mr. Watkins, I'm going to jump right in because I noticed that in this case, the defendant had a preliminary hearing, and when I reviewed it last night, there were the two victims that testified that this occurred on Anthem Parkway at the intersection listed in the information. You had an off-duty Henderson City fire engineer who testified he was driving on his way home and observed the accident right there on Anthem Parkway. And then you have a police officer from Henderson that arrived at the scene. They all testified at a preliminary hearing of where this occurred, and then that's listed on the information. So it's not the facts that you're saying where a car goes through a living room. Here, the facts were established through the preliminary hearing, and ultimately it was also recounted on the information that this was a public street in Henderson. So why is this reversible error under those facts?
Reversible error because the substitution of the misdemeanor location elements for the felony elements does not charge a public offense. And the fact that this may, the fact that the state could prove what the state alleged, if it's not a crime, everything is null and void. For example, this court 3 days ago in Lavelle, which is on point here, concluded that DUI murder is not a public offense, and therefore the state cannot create its own offense. Lavelle is on point, and the district attorney cannot create its own DUI offense, and that's what they did here. And furthermore, the district attorney in this case is they filed this created commingled offense against some defendants and not all defendants. And most importantly, the state has admitted repeatedly that Jack Banca was unlawfully charged. Therefore, the appeal should be reversed based upon the fact that the district attorney cannot create its own offense. And again, Lavelle is on point. A DUI murder is not a public offense, yet the district attorney created one. And this court, Lavelle, says you can't do that because it's not a public offense.
Didn't Lavelle, though, we really rested it based on Lamont and based on the fact that stare decisis that for, oh, I don't know, over, you know, 30, 40 years, that has been the law as far as DUI unintentional death. How is that the same, stare decisis, following Lamont, the same as this?
Because what the district attorney did in Lavelle was created its own DUI murder offense.
No, and Mr. this Watkins, court, it didn't create its own murder offense. It's whether they could be charged with second-degree murder. I think Lavelle's kind of a non-starter with respect to application here. There is a legitimate claim that you've mixed, that two elements or elements have been mixed. I'd like to focus on that, and I'd also like to focus on the problems in the plea agreement and the colloquy. that don't give a mandatory minimum penalty for fines.
Yes. I'll talk about the unconstitutionality of the plea. In this case, Jack Banka did not understand all the elements of the offense of a 44C-430 because they were not alleged in the charging document. The misdemeanors were, location elements were in fact alleged in the charging document. Two prosecutors, the prior defense attorney and the district court itself, did not know the elements of 44C-430. So obviously Jack Banka cannot be held to have known the elements when they didn't as well. Also, you're aware in this case that the admonishment of rights that Jack was required to execute indicated that he was charged with a violation of the misdemeanor statute 44C-379, which is now 44C.110. And the penalties for that in the admonishment, which was attached as Exhibit 2 of the guilty plea agreement, the penalties were 1 to 6 years in the Nevada State Prison. The district court did not, this is a conflict between what was alleged in Exhibit 1 versus what's Exhibit 2. The district court did not clear this conflict up. Also, the district court did not address any of the elements in this particular case with Jack Banka. So we have no idea that Jack Banka understood any of the elements in this case. Also, he did not understand the consequences of the plea. The judge did not know that there was a mandatory fine that was to be imposed.
But Mr. Watkins, in that case, and I will grant you that the plea agreement is incorrect. There's no doubt on the consequences of the plea. However, didn't the oral plea canvas fix any problems with that guilty plea memorandum in that she did in fact tell him it was a mandatory fine of up to $5,000, which is correct. Granted, she didn't give the minimum, but she said it could be up to $5,000, and he understood that. And ultimately, he was given a $2,000 fine. And one more thing, if this was an agreement to stipulate, so he agreed with the state to stipulate to 4 to 10. How under Stevenson is it fair and just to allow him to withdraw his plea if ultimately he got from Ellsworth what he asked for in the plea agreement, which was a 4 to 10?
Because, number one, what he entered a plea to was not an offense. It was not a public offense because of the commingling situation, the mixing of the misdemeanor elements with the felony elements. So, number one, there's no charge to begin with. Second off, his pleading and stipulating doesn't somehow turn in a charging document that does not state a public offense into one that does. And I believe clearly that the judge, when she says it's up to a maximum, she was required to tell him that it would be a minimum of $2,000. So he really didn't understand. Okay, taking the totality of the situation, that he didn't understand the elements of a 44C-430 violation, and the conflict between Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 2, and no mention of any elements whatsoever by the district judge that she could determine whether he was even aware of any of these elements and understood them. Okay. Clearly, the plea is constitutionally infirm. And therefore, again, I'd like to go back to the commingling issue. The district attorney, without any legal authority, created its own DUI offense by commingling two separate and distinct statutory offenses, misdemeanor NRS 44C-110 and the felony NRS 44C-430, to charge Jack Banka. Again, there's no statute that authorizes the district attorney to create its own offense. And without a statute authorizing them to be able to do this, there's no crime. Jack Banka was not charged with a public offense. And the fact that it's alleged that it occurred, you know, at a particular location does not make that which is not a crime a crime. Therefore, the appeals should be granted on both issues. Number one, the charging document does not state a public offense. And number two, he did not understand the nature of the offense, that is, the elements of the offense or the consequences of the plea in this case.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Watkins. You have about 5 minutes and 2 seconds. You may reserve that. Mr. Giles, on behalf of the state, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael Giles on behalf of the respondent. In this case, the charge was sufficient to place the appellant on notice of what he had to defend against, and he failed to meet his burden of proving that he did not knowingly and intelligently enter into his plea. As an initial matter, the state was not proving a new statute. It was merely a drafting error. 110 is not a misdemeanor statute. In fact, it does not establish felony or misdemeanor behavior. It simply establishes the elements to prove a DUI, including limits on alcohol and other substances. In order to find out if it's a felony or a misdemeanor, one needs to look at 44C-400, the penalty statute, or 44C.430, the penalty for death or substantial bodily harm statute. It's uncontested that the title in this case charged a DUI with substantial bodily harm. It established that the event occurred in Henderson, Nevada, Clark County on a highway, Mr. Bonica violated a traffic rule and caused a collision, then he fled from that scene, and that collision caused injury in Axiom Legal. Those were uncontested and on the face of the document. He had more than sufficient information to defend against that charge. It's longstanding in this state, both statutorily and in case law, that errors in pleadings do not invalidate them if sufficient notice is provided. NRS 175-07.
But this is an error of the law. This is an error of you just commingling two statutes together to make your own crime.
How
is that not reversible error?
Because it was an error that was in an element. And under 175-0753, an error in citation or omission is not grounds for dismissal or reversal if it didn't work to defendant's prejudice. The charging document said highway, and all of the testimony available said it was a roadway and a highway. In Watkins v. Sheriff, the word furnish was used in a drug case where the word furnish does not appear anywhere in the statute, and the court found that neither the statutes nor the cited cases insist upon strict conformity to statutory phraseology and charging portions if words used convey the same meaning as statute and substantial rights of defendant are not prejudiced. So it did not create a new charge, and it provided more than sufficient notice to Mr. Bonica to defend against it. Likewise, in Levinson, it was an involuntary manslaughter case where the state left out an entire portion of the statute that the words which were probably might produce such a consequence in an unlawful manner. The appeal on that case was under 173-0751, the same statute Mr. Watkins is appealing under here, and the court in that case found that all of the information combined was sufficient to place the defendant on notice, and so therefore, even though that language was missing from the statute, it was a valid charge. In State v. Jones, the wrong person was named as having been the purchaser of drugs. But the court noted that because there was a grand jury transcript and discovery and defendant had an opportunity to evaluate all of those things, that they were on notice, and it was merely an error that did not work to their detriment. Citing to NRS 178-598, they said any error, defect, irregularity, or variance which does not affect the substantial right shall be disregarded. Here, the appellant had a preliminary hearing. He heard where the accident occurred. He knew it was on a highway. The charging document said highway, although not the exact phraseology from NRS 44C-430, which is really just an expansion of the charge, because in that particular instance, any location is chargeable as opposed to the limited locations under the 110 language. But the answer here is that it was a valid charge, and even if the error in that one element, which we don't dispute, was in there, it placed him on notice, and with the assistance of counsel, the preliminary hearing, of the information he had available to him, including the correct citation to the statute NRS 440, he was able to defend against that particular statute and against the charges that were brought against him. I would note that it was his decision to plead in this case and that he asked for terms, including the entry.
Mr. Giles, how do you reconcile that? And I'm looking at the transcript of the plea. So your plea agreement's wrong, completely wrong. It doesn't even give mandatory time. Mandatory fine. Doesn't say it's mandatory. It says may. Then it says up to 5,000. That's wrong. Then I look at the plea right here, your canvas, and where you have the opportunity, because the court figures out that it's mandatory, you don't correct the court again on the canvas, and you don't say minimum 2, maximum 5.
That is correct,
Your Honor. So that's wrong as well, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And as you read that, plea canvas was a little bit tense, and that originally Ms. Lavelle was handling it, and I stepped in to assist when things were a little bit challenging.
Right here, it says, Mr. Giles, it's mandatory, Your Honor, it's. And then the court says, quote, a mandatory fine of up to 5,000. Mr. Giles, yes. But you don't correct the court. That's you. That's not Ms. Lavelle. I'm reading what you said. You said mandatory fine, but you didn't correct the court and say minimum 2, maximum 5. So the plea canvas is wrong too, right?
As to that, you are correct, Your Honor. However, the transcript does not show that the judge continued talking and I did not step over her. That is my error. I should have stepped in and said that. There's no question about that. But the fact that he later filed a motion to withdraw his plea, claiming that if he'd only known it was $2,000 minimum instead of much less, which is what the court had told him it could be, that he wouldn't have entered his plea. The court found that to simply not be credible. I do not disagree, however, that the plea canvas and that guilty plea agreement had incorrect language in it. But the court,
how many errors do we allow the state to make to affirm a judgment of conviction? Because we've listed quite a few. That the charging document has errors. Your written plea agreement has clear errors of law. Your plea canvas is a clear error of law. How many? At what point does this prejudice the defendant?
Well, the question is if it's a substantial prejudice to his rights. And stating that he had a maximum of a $5,000 potential fine without stating the minimum fine, I would argue, does not substantially deny his rights, because throughout the plea canvas, the court made it clear. There was a jury standing in the hallway. He waited until the morning of trial to enter this plea. It was an Alford plea. He asked us for the plea. We rushed to get these documents together to do that. And so I do not have an answer as to how many total mistakes become too many and cumulative. But that particular portion is not substantive necessarily as to his desire to enter into a plea, because he stated over and over again that he wanted to avoid the more substantial penalties if he went to trial and lost. He was facing a potential maximum sentence of 16 to 40 years on the two charges that he faced. He negotiated this. He talked to his counsel. And under the Jezierski case, pleas entered with the assistance of counsel are presumptively valid. Additionally, and I know that the appellant has argued that the waiver of any defects, which Mr. Bowley put on the record, only applies to the fact that there was an interlineation to strike the second count. But that's not what Mr. Bowley said. What Mr. Bowley said is much more similar to the Brault case, where the parties stipulated in writing to a sentence that was outside of the standard 40% requirement, and the court found that once a stipulation or a waiver of those rights was entered into, he couldn't go back and then argue, well, but that violated my rights even though I waived those rights. In this case, what counsel said was, we'll waive any defects assuming the plea goes through today. And that's because Mr. Bowley consulted with Defendant Bonka, and Defendant Bonka wanted to enter this plea. rather than going
to trial. Isn't waiving defects generally in the pleading having to do with fictitious pleas? They just want to get a lower plea down. They want the benefit of a lighter punishment, and so they waive defects in the pleading. They don't necessarily waive defects in their constitutional rights or notice of the consequences of a plea.
Well, they don't normally, but it's possible to do. For example, it's possible for a defendant to waive rights to appeal, which would be a constitutional right if they so choose to. In this case, the defects were to the pleadings and to the documents, because it was clear to all parties at that point that there were errors in those documents that Mr. Bonka wanted to waive in order to get through the canvas and to get the benefit of his bargain, his negotiation.
Mr. Giles?
Yes.
If I may, because I'm not giving the mandatory minimum fine, not informing him of that. You asserted that the judge didn't believe him when he stated in his declaration as one of the reasons he wanted to withdraw his plea. If I had known it was a $2,000 floor, I would have asked for a trial. Is that one of his stated bases? And you asserted that the judge didn't believe that. And I'm kind of trying to mine the record that I have in front of me while we're doing that. Did the judge make that finding in an order, that credibility finding?
No,
I don't believe you, or what? Or is that just your interpretation?
It's just at that point when we were arguing those points, she expressed that just wasn't credible to her. She didn't believe that was a factor. It was in an oral statement. I do not know specifically where it is in the record, but it was not part of the written order.
Okay, thank you.
So the question is whether or not it's fair and just to withdraw the plea. Under Stevenson requires that the fair and just standard be applied to not only the defendant, but also to the state. More importantly, the question of timing was of great interest in Stevenson. In this case, timing is also an issue, because when Mr. Watkins was substituted in place of Mr. Bowley, they did not immediately attempt to withdraw the plea. And as the court has held, the purpose of allowing withdraw a plea is to allow somebody who made a mistake and now wants to make a change, not to wait and make a tactical decision, but to do that. In this case, we went to sentencing. Mr. Watkins advised the court there was no legal cause or reason not to proceed to sentencing. And then once the court adjudicated Mr. Bonka guilty, he struck in and said he wanted to file a motion for arrest judgment. That was fully briefed. After it was fully briefed, but before we argued it, Mr. Watkins filed a motion to withdraw the plea, citing as his only standard the 110 language versus 430 language. Once the court had denied the motion to arrest judgment based upon that finding that 1730753 allowed for some error, and as long as that error didn't work to prejudice the defendant, it would not be cause to set aside the information or allow a reversal. He then filed an amended motion to withdraw plea, citing four standards. Those four standards included ineffective assistance of counsel for not filing motions. As court is aware, under Ennis, counsel cannot be ineffective for filing motions that have no basis for them or which would be futile. And in this case, the motions that Mr. Watkins has cited, Armstrong, motion to suppress the PDT, motion to suppress the blood, after implied consent, would have all been futile. Armstrong deals with retrograde analysis of a single blood draw drawn outside of 2 hours. This was already a 2-hour case. There's no question the blood was drawn with consent. That was the testimony of the officer at the preliminary hearing. It was never refuted in any shape or form. That Mr. Bonka never requested a blood test. He selected a blood test, and that blood test was drawn within 2 hours. So an Armstrong motion would have yielded no results. Likewise, the PDT could not be used. Mr. Bowler actually opposed that at the preliminary hearing, and he won on that issue. Finally, the motion that Mr. Watkins files in almost every case, the however slight language, the state agrees that it takes that out any time he asks, because it's not the operative portion of the impairment statute. The operative portion is that no matter how much alcohol is found in the person's system, the state, to prevail, must show that that amount caused the person to be incapable of safely driving. And in this case, it wasn't even an issue in the case. So I see that I'm down to 35 seconds, unless the court has any other questions.
I have a question. Mr. Giles?
Yes.
Would we be having the same conversation about understanding the consequences of the plea if the court had failed to give the defendant information about the mandatory minimum imprisonment? So if the court had said, use the same language they used on the fines, and said you can get up mandatory up to 20 years, but didn't inform the defendant that there was a mandatory minimum of service, would we be having the same conversation that we're having about fines? Would your position be the same? And why should we treat fines differently than we do imprisonment?
We would not be having the same conversation, because the mandatory minimum of 2 years, if, for example, the court had said that, you know, it could be a year or I could give you probation, that would be absolutely and completely and totally incorrect. The reason that it's not as large an issue when it comes to the $2,000 fines is, as the court said, statutes allow her to waive fines, even when they're mandatory, if she finds after a hearing that the individual has no ability to pay them. And regardless of that, knowing that the fine could be $5,000, and Mr. Bonka said that wasn't even an issue, the fact that it could be up to $5,000, the minimum fine there is not a substantial right. The loss of his liberty for 2 years, when he thought it was going to be 1 year or potentially a probation, would be substantially different, and I would not make the same argument in that case.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Giles. Mr. Watkins, we ran over with Mr. Giles about a minute, so we'll add a minute to your time to even it out. So you have almost 6 minutes. You may proceed with your rebuttal.
First off, I'd like to point out there's no error in citation issue in this case. This is a red herring. An error in citation is if all the elements of the felony statute were alleged in the charging document, but the state said it was 44C110, the misdemeanor. That would be an error in citation. There's no error in citation here. The state intended to file and use two statutes to create their own offense in this case. And as evidence that it was intentional, they actually took the misdemeanor elements and commingled them with the felony elements. So this court clearly needs to know there is no error in citation. Notice, the state is trying to make some kind of a notice with the, you know, that they have pled, and so he had notice. Well, in Lavelle, the defendant, Ronald Lavelle, had notice that he was being charged with second-degree murder. However, this court said that still doesn't make it a crime. So notice doesn't make that which is not a crime a crime. Variance, in order to have variance, you have to have a public offense being charged. And then that's when variance would come in. I'd like to point out that the state is incorrect when it says that our client, Jack Banka, said that he would withdraw his plea if he knew it was a $2,000 fine. That is not the record in this case, and I told the judge that was not the record because she said something about that, and I called her attention that what we said in our briefing was that if he knew that the element of the 44C felony was not the correct element that was alleged, if he knew about the conflict between the Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 2, that is the admonishment of rights that he was required to sign, and the fact that he was not advised of the monetary penalty, then he would have withdrawn his plea. So it's not that he said, if I didn't know it was $2,000 fine. That is absolutely, totally incorrect and a misstatement by the prosecution. And I noticed the prosecution never said anything, the state never said anything about admitting that Jack Banka was unlawfully charged. They actually stated, you know, several times that he was unlawfully charged and that if it went to trial, they would have to change their charging document to satisfy the elements of the felony statute. By the way, I looked up Lavelle and the indictment in Lavelle. They actually allege the correct elements of 44C-430, on or off the highways of the state, which means it's anywhere within the state of Nevada.
I'm sorry, did you say, Mr. Watkins, did you say the state acknowledged that they could not have gone to trial on the information that was charged? And if so, yes. Where is that in the record?
Yes, and I believe it's appellate's appendix 61 and 60. They said that they would have changed what they pled to comply with the elements of the felony statute. If I could have the court's attention here. Again, the dispositive issue here is that the district attorney created its own offense. They commingle two separate and distinct statutory offenses. They can't do that. They have to charge each and every element of 44C 430. They did not, in fact, do that. And by the way, the state is saying, oh, well, the fine doesn't really mean anything. Constitutionally, this plea was constitutionally infirm. You have to know and be aware of all the elements of the offense and the consequences of the plea, which includes the monetary penalties as well as any incarceration. So they're trying to take life and, oh, well, you know. And what's really interesting is, number one, how, again, two prosecutors, prior defense counsel, and the district court didn't even know the proper element of a 44C 430 violation. And it's certainly, you know, surprising to me and somewhat disturbing, to say the truth here, is that how can a district court not know that the fine is mandatory, yet you're supposed to have a colloquy with the defendant to make sure that he understands all this. This plea, this charge is unconstitutional. It does not state a public offense. The plea is constitutionally infirm. And also, I didn't get into, but, you know, there's a discretionary issue. I'm working on the unconstitutionality of the plea and the fair and just that he should have been allowed to withdraw the plea. The separate issue is that there was an ineffective assistance of counsel. There was no motions filed in this particular case. And I totally disagree with the state when they say that the Armstrong motion is irrelevant. Armstrong was actually a case that was decided by this court, okay, favorably for a defendant. This court also decided Sample, okay, which deals with the PVT. Our client did not consent, okay? There's nothing in the record other than police saying that our client consented to do this. Our client was told that if he didn't take the PVT, he was going to lose his driver's license in the particular case. And also, our client was not given the choice of having breath or blood. Okay, these motions should have been filed. Any effective counsel would have, in fact, filed them. So from a discretionary standpoint, just dealing with whether it should have, you know, fair and just, I believe the court was error by not allowing it based upon that circumstance. But the court has no obligation or no right to, in fact, not withdraw a plea when it's constitutionally infirm. And therefore, I'm asking that you reverse, okay, this decision and allow Jack Banka to go to trial on these issues. Because we were
thank
not.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. Your time's up. Thank you, Mr. Giles. We appreciate both your excellent arguments and briefs in this very interesting issue. The court will take this matter under submission and will be in recess till the next call of the court.
Thank you very much.